Hello and welcome to the Pax Mundi show. First off, news from the dark side. Good news this week. Wikipedia have released another 7 million diplomatic files from the 1970s. These are US Foreign Service emails and telegrams from the 1970s. These files were technically available under the Freedom of Information legislation, but were very difficult to find for members of the public. Now you can go up there on the Wikipedia site and download all of this information. Julian Assange has actually done all of this work himself, putting all these files up there, and he's been doing that from his refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's claimed political asylum from the British authorities, who wanted to send him back to Sweden, to extradite him to Sweden on purely investigative charges, where he may then subsequently be sent to the US on treason charges. Now, a lot of these files relate back to a very dark period of US activity, both in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, Cambodia, also in Latin America, where they were engaged in lots of black operations, promoting military regimes. And there's a lot of obviously interesting information. So moving on, over in Colombia, there's been a lot of public support and demonstrations in support of the peace process, the negotiations that are ongoing currently in Havana between the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and commonly known as FARC. After a 30-year armed struggle, the FARC have finally managed to get the Colombian government to sit down with them and talk about their demands. Now, a lot of these demands were about human rights in indigenous areas, about land reform, principally land reform, and economic issues. So that's good news from Colombia, and it's good news to hear that the Cuban government is playing a positive role in facilitating these peace talks and negotiations in Havana. Peace talks are the way, really. The armed struggle has clearly, you know, been a necessity where people have been under attack from reactionary forces, but ultimately you can't settle anything through military force and the use of military force, and dialogue is the way forward. Unfortunately, often peace processes don't always go the way that you want them, and often the authorities are using this purely as a tactic in order to stall and delay and undermine progressive forces, such as in Israel with the Palestinians. Now, one peace process that has been ongoing in Europe is the Basque independence struggle. So, after about 40 or more years of armed struggle, the ETA organization from the Basque country in Spain, who want their independence, have ended the armed struggle. They've agreed a ceasefire and entered into dialogue with the Spanish and French governments. Now, these talks were ongoing in France. Unfortunately, it appears that the authorities, the Spanish and French governments, have actually been just using this as a stalling process, and that, you know, they now appear to be less than serious about moving things forward and about creating real change in the Basque province of Spain and France. And meanwhile, ETA prisoners in France are being mistreated, they're being placed in isolation, and their lawyers are being harassed. Now, the harassment of lawyers is and prosecution of lawyers is a widespread practice, and that's going on in many other countries. So we do hope that the Basque negotiations get back on track. Moving over to Korea, where last week I talked about the escalation of the potential hostilities between North Korea and South Korea, involving the wider Southeast Asian area. Japan is being escalated by U.S. rhetoric, U.S. government rhetoric. Now, this continues this week. We've seen the North Korean government has withdrawn all of their workers from the economic initiative that they'd created with the South Korean business, which was introducing an economic liberalization to allow these South Korean businesses to actually exploit North Korean labor. So that project has been halted. Meanwhile, U.S. Military maneuvers, joint maneuvers with South Korea have continued. The U.S. has sent more missiles to Japan this time now. And whilst North Korea is clearly, you know, continuing to respond to that rhetoric with its own dogmatic rhetoric, the U.S. is escalating it. This time, their line is that if North Korea fires nuclear missiles at South Korea, the U.S. claims it can shoot them down, so therefore there's nothing to worry about. Now, this is very, very, very dangerous. We are moving closer and closer to a potential nuclear conflict. And well, this rhetoric coming from the U.S. is clearly pushing things to the edge, and really what is needed is a de-escalation and more talk, real talk and negotiations rather than retro. Hello and welcome to the Pax Mundi show. Our main topic for tonight is the prevent strategy in the UK, the government's prevent strategy. Now, this week, government announced that it was recruiting for 10 regional prevent coordinators. This is across the UK. Now, these coordinators are based regionally, and there will be two in the northwest of England, here in the northwest of England, and one of those will be based in Manchester. Now, that will be at Manchester University. Now, that's principally their sphere of activity will be around the universities and higher education sector in the Northwest, along with community organisations. So, what I want to do tonight is to give a bit of background to what the prevent strategy is. The prevent strategy is a part of the UK government's strategy against terrorism, against domestic and international terrorism. The UK government promotes an atmosphere of fear whereby all of the time the threat of terrorist attack is at, continuously being repeated and re-emphasized in the media for the public. So it's about creating a climate of fear. Now, they maintain that there is a strong possibility of a terrorist attack, and that they need to respond to the threat to the UK from Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda leadership, and who are based allegedly in the border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and their affiliates, alleged affiliate groups, who are based in other areas, allegedly in the Sahel, Sahara region of Africa, in Somalia, Yemen, etc. Also to deal with the threat of domestic terrorism. Now, the government's counter-terrorism strategy has been broken down into four areas of work. The first is pursue to stop terrorist attacks. This is through the intelligence agencies, police services, etc., infiltrating alleged terrorist groups. Other parts of the programme are protect, that is to strengthen our protection against terrorist attack, and prepare to mitigate the impact of a terrorist attack. Now, the last part of this strategy is prevent, so that is nominally to prevent, to stop people from becoming terrorists or supporting terrorism. And so this is a massive domestic spying program that was created in 2005 following the 7/7 attacks. The details of which are still requiring an investigation. Now, following those attacks, the UK government launched a program of reaching out to the Muslim communities and trying to find out what had led to this act of domestic terrorism. The alleged perpetrators of the 7/7 bombings were not foreigners. They were British Muslims who were not involved or affiliated or whatever to any foreign groups. And so they had a process of consultation with Muslim community groups, and the recommendations that came back from this consultation were first of all to demand a public inquiry. So that was to demand a public inquiry into the 7/7 attacks, and that also to that the solution to preventing this kind of attack was actually to deal with the discrimination and deprivation of Muslim communities and marginalisation of Muslim communities in the UK, and also to look at the impact of UK foreign policy on Muslim communities. This was our involvement in the occupation of Iraq, of Afghanistan, and the impact that these foreign policies were having on the Muslim communities. So that was a first stage of reaching out to the Muslim communities, government initiatives, and their recommendations, the two of which I've just outlined, you know, to look at British foreign policy and domestic policy effect on Muslims, and to hold an inquiry into the 7/7 bombings, have never been implemented. So clearly you can see there that the UK government was never really serious about consulting with the Muslim community. They didn't want to hear what the Muslim community had to say. They instead actually wanted to achieve two or three things. One, to try to manipulate the Islamic community, to try to control their community organizations, to effectively a social engineering project, and thirdly, to gain intelligence. Now, the PREVENT program has had a lot, there's been a lot of money spent on this. For example, in the budget for 2008-09, it was over £140 million. This year, we're seeing a reduced budget due to government cuts. It's been cut back to about £60 million this year. But the programme is continuing, and it is, if anything, being deepened. Now, it's as a part of the government's counter-terrorist strategy, it is focusing on mobilizing communities, the Muslim community, to oppose the ideology of violent extremism. And they claim that it is community-led. Now, the way in which it's been implemented so far has been really anything but that. A lot of the work has been done at a local authority level with a regional oversight. So these regional officers of the Prevent program are liaising with local authorities, who then use third sector organizations, community organizations, to implement their ideas about Islam and to communicate with the Muslim community about what is an acceptable version of Islam, to create an acceptable version of Islam that is acceptable to the UK government. This means that it is not one that is supporting extremism or terrorism. Now, unfortunately, this often means that they are looking at the ideas of the Muslim community and effectively criminalizing them. So we look at the some of the issues that they are trying to influence within Muslim thought, within mosques, within Muslim community groups. What has been proscribed effectively is policies relating to the elimination of Israel, the idea that Israel is an illegal state and it is a Zionist state and should not continue to exist in its current state. It is prescribed by the UK government. It is not deemed to be an acceptable policy. And therefore, any Islamic groups who advocate the end of Israel, and I don't mean the end through violent means, but that Israel should not continue to exist, and advocate for the liberation of Palestine, is not acceptable to the UK government, and that is deemed by them, by the Prevent Programme, to be advocating and supporting terrorism. Other policies which are also unacceptable is the demand for the withdrawal of Western forces from Muslim countries, the demand for previously for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq, Western troops from Iraq, and now the demand for withdrawal of Western troops from Afghanistan, and an end to the involvement of Western military forces in areas such as Somalia, or now the French forces in Mali, in Africa. These demands are perceived as being unreasonable. And this is actually, again, you know, this is a quite a, you know, a reasonable demand and idea that many British people support, many American people support, many Europeans support the idea that our military forces should be withdrawn from Muslim lands, and that we have no positive role to play in these countries. So again, the support for the call for the withdrawal of Western forces is perceived as being, you know, a support for terrorism and, you know, advocating terrorism. Another big issue, which is often misunderstood and which we are misinformed about, is about Sharia law and the idea of the caliphate. Now, we're always hearing and seeing claims in the Western media by Islamophobic and right-wing organizations that Muslims want to implement Sharia law, that they want to create a caliphate, as though, you know, these are wild ideas that are, backward and regressive and really that we should prescribe and prevent. We should prevent them demanding, you know, the idea of Sharia law and the caliphate. Now, Sharia law or religious law is something that every religion has its own rules. A lot of Sharia law is actually mainly fatwas and rules around the way that they practice Islam. So what our government is doing is telling Muslims what they should talk about, what they should aspire to, that they should not aspire to having Sharia law, and that they should not aspire to a caliphate. Now, again, the idea of a caliphate would be effectively a union of Muslim countries. Now, we have the United States, which is a union of states. We have the European Union, which is a union of European states. We have the Russian Federation, which is a union of Russian and states around peripheral to Russia. So, why is the idea of a union of Muslim states so outrageous? Surely, you know, this is something that should be allowed, or certainly the idea of it is quite reasonable, much like the African Union or the Arab Union, these groups of states. Going further, the UK government has actually prescribed many Muslim organisations because of their political aims. So we've actually made them illegal. How this is seen as preventing terrorism, I really don't understand, because clearly if you prevent people from having from trying to achieve their aims and goals and ideas and aspirations through legitimate means, legitimate political activity, by prescribing their organizations, that is making them illegal, then you are pushing them more towards violent activity. That is the way that I see it. So what we saw was the prescription of, for example, a organization called Hizb-ut-Tahrir. Now, Hizb-ut-Tahrir was a political party. It was an Islamic political party based in the UK, and what they were advocating was that Muslims should not participate in the democratic process within the UK, because that was actually not in any way furthering the aspirations and ideas of Islam, and that they should actually boycott the political system because none of the other political parties were would be representing Muslims. Now, this seems quite a reasonable position. It doesn't seem one that is, it's certainly they weren't threatening violent activity, and they weren't engaged in any kind of terrorist activity, but they were actually made illegal in 2007. And even more than that, we've seen the that this does not work, this process of criminalizing Islamic organizations, criminalizing community organizations which don't meet our standards, our criteria. Will never work. It was a failed policy to some extent. It had previously been tried in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. The British government had attempted to criminalise Irish Catholic organizations, to criminalize their leaders, and in the hope that would actually end their resistance. Now, that it didn't work then, and it's not going to work now. So this is a failed policy that's being implemented once again. Likewise, with the demonization of certain places of worship where they couldn't control them. So the prevent policy is basically about controlling and telling them, the Islamic community, the Muslim community, what it's safe to do and say in the UK, what they must think if and say and do if they want to live without problems in the UK. Therefore, we would get imams who would not speak about the things that they really wanted to speak about, would not speak about the things that their congregations wanted to hear about. For example, I myself remember, you know, during the run-up to the during the Iraq War, when we were campaigning, you know, against British involvement in the Iraq War, I had a lot of meetings with the Muslim community here where I live, and had meetings with the imam, and in private, you know, they would say, you know, yes, you know, this is wrong, we agree with you, we can't, you know, we were totally against this, and this we support what you're saying. But in a public arena, what they said to me was, look, we can't say this in a public arena, we're not allowed to, we have to keep our heads down, else they'll get chopped off. And those were literally the words from the imam. You know, we have to keep our heads down, else they'll get chopped off, and I'd advise you to keep yours down. Well, luckily, I mean, I don't have to do that because I'm not a Muslim, and because I'm a white Caucasian. At the moment, I've got a lot more leeway to actually speak my mind and, you know, speak against all of this evil that is being carried on in our name by our governments. But for the Islamic community, they haven't got this choice. Now, where Muslim congregations didn't listen to what they were being advised by their prevent coordinators, government agents, and where they continued to allow people to preach in the mosques, preachers such as perhaps you know, Abu Hamza, and anybody who wasn't basically towing the government line, the prevent line, who was talking against the occupations, against the marginalization of the Islamic community, then they were proscribed. Mosques were actually threatened with closure. And in one or two cases, mosques were actually closed for short periods of time under the Prevention of Terrorism Act. This is another aspect of the Prevention of Terrorism Act. Now, here, getting back to where I started, in Manchester, we're now having these this prevent coordinator being appointed to our universities, where they will be furthering the work that they've already been carrying out of basically spying on students, spying on teachers, collecting intelligence, and also creating an atmosphere of fear. This is actually happening in our societies, in our communities. And we need to resist this. This is the kind of activity that we used to, at one time, associate with Soviet Russia or East Germany, where all civil organizations were controlled by political police, by the Stasi. Now, this is what these people are. They are the Stasi. And for the Muslim community, they've got this infiltration of their own community that's been carried on now since about 2005. There's been a deep infiltration. People, some do it for money. Those who are appointed to these jobs by the local communities or within the universities to spy on their colleagues and to further the implementation of the acceptable UK version of Islam. This we also have underneath that another layer of people, young people particularly, who are being coerced into spying, being threatened, being blackmailed into spying on their own communities, into reporting back to the authorities about individuals at their mosques, in their associations. And in some cases, these people later go on to become agent provocateurs or even alleged perpetrators of terrorism if they don't continue to cooperate with their controllers. So what I'm looking to do is really widen this discussion to see what the rest of you think about out there. So that's it for the moment. I'm just going to see if we'll play a few tunes for you and see if anybody wants to call me.